that song. That's a good one to sing, especially when we have communion. All right, we're going to invite the children now to children's church, so kids up through third grade can start going, making their way to the back and follow the group out, and they'll have a study at their own level, worship the Lord. You can open your Bibles, please, to Isaiah 34. When God decided to reveal himself to us, he chose to do it by putting information into a book. And the next decision that God was faced with was what to reveal first, what to put on the first page of that book. When he's going to tell us about himself, what is the very first thing he wants us to hear? And like all of the decisions God makes, he made a perfect one and chose to begin with an emphatic statement about the fact that he created everything and spent a whole week making the place habitable for us. And when he was done, it was very good. And that's really emphasized heavily, of course, in Genesis 1. The word good, the Hebrew word tov, in Greek it's kalos. It's a very profound term. A couple of times we've spent a whole message just preaching on how that term is used in Scripture, and that those messages have been some of the most requested messages we've ever done here because it's such a beautiful, profound, rich, deep concept of goodness of God. I'm not going to review that whole message again right now, but let me tell you the summary. Tov, or goodness, or kalos, is basically the difference between a desolate desert wasteland and a perfect paradise. When God finished making things kalos, good, the result was the Garden of Eden, paradise. He created everything good. I suppose one reason why the Bible starts that way is because God knew that we would all be wondering, if he made this place, if he created this place, why is there so much trouble, so many problems, so much sin, evil, and all that? And the answer is, he didn't have those problems when he created it. That's the point of Genesis 1. That's one major point. He created it only tov, kalos, good. And the problems didn't come until two chapters later when man sinned. Man's sin resulted in judgment and the curse, and that transformed paradise into desolation. And with that in mind, let's look at Isaiah 34. In Isaiah 34, God is absolutely furious with humanity. Verse 1, "Come near, you nations, and listen. Pay attention, you peoples. Let the earth hear, and all that is in it, the world, and all that comes out of it. Yahweh is angry with the nations." So God is mad, he's angry. In verse 9, Isaiah is describing the judgment that comes as a result of his anger. Edom's streams, and by the way, Edom here represents all the nations in Isaiah 34. "Edom's streams will be turned into pitch, her dust into burning sulfur. Her land will become blazing pitch. It will not be quenched night and day. Its smoke will rise forever. From generation to generation it will lie desolate. No one will ever pass through it again. The desert owl, the screech owl, will possess it. The great owl and the raven will nest there. God will stretch out over Edom the measuring line of chaos and the plumb line of desolation." Those two words, chaos and desolation, are in the Hebrew tohu and bohu. You remember those from Genesis 1, the words translated formless and empty in the beginning of Genesis 1. So the idea is he's going to make the place totally uninhabitable. In poetic language, Isaiah is saying God's judgment is going to be so severe that he is going to turn this place into such a wasteland that it's going to be like the creation prior to the 6 days where God makes it habitable. The rest of the chapter goes on to describe the horrible, hideous, lethal desolation of a desert. And the imagery in this chapter is really very rich in symbolism. Obviously, Isaiah is talking about judgment that goes way beyond just physical climate. I hope you understand that. It's not just talking about a desert and sand and all that. Just as the curse in Genesis 3 goes way beyond thorns, right? The point is, life itself will become thorny. That's the idea of Genesis 3. And here, the idea is life will be fruitless, dominated by death, and where life does exist, it will be a struggle. Have you noticed how the second law of thermodynamics seems to apply just across the board? It's not just physical things, is it? It applies to mental things, emotional things, spiritual things. Left unattended, your prayer life will become as weedy and dead as your garden when it's left unattended, right? Without constant nurturing of your relationships, they will dry up just like your lawn dries up when you don't water it. You take a little time off managing your spiritual life and it'll become as much a chaotic disaster as your garage when you don't care for that. That's the curse. That's the leech of death that's just clamped on to the life that exists in this world, sucking the lifeblood dry and turning the place into a desert. And when you read about the desert in Isaiah here, that's not just talking about literal sand and arid climate. It's talking about the beauty, the goodness, the colossus of life drying up. That's what Isaiah 34 is about. So suddenly what may have sounded like a very irrelevant chapter a moment ago, when Tommy read it, you probably were all wondering when he got done reading, what was that? What kind of a worship thing is that to read? It sounds like the most irrelevant chapter there is. If you understand this symbolism here, it becomes as relevant as it gets, doesn't it? I mean, we can all relate to this chapter. Everyone in this room knows what it's like when the colossus of life dries up. The desert owls and the buzzards of verses 13 to 15 have been circling around your life maybe all week, and your soul has become so parched and dry that from time to time you just collapse in exhaustion. And usually when you do so, you land on some cactus somewhere, and that's just the way this life is. It's prickly, it's thorny, it's dried up. This desert imagery, this whole thing that Isaiah 34 is talking about, this is why your back aches. This is why you get migraines. This is the reason your spouse disappoints you and your kids hurt you, and it's the reason your bills pile up faster than your paychecks and all that. We groan in this life because we were designed to live in a wonderful, beautiful, good, colossus paradise, and for now we're stuck in a dried up, trackless wasteland. And without the irrigation from God's word and prayer, things just get worse. And the irrigation pipes themselves are in constant need of maintenance because our very prayer life can dry up. So with all that in mind, if you understand that, I shouldn't even have to preach chapter 35 of Isaiah. You understand chapter 34. Chapter 35 is as obvious as it can get. As usual, Isaiah announces judgment but then promises deliverance. That's his mode all through the book. And the deliverance comes in chapter 35. Just listen to it. You're going to understand it. The desert and the parched land will be glad, and the wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, and the splendor of Carmel and Sharon, and they will see the glory of Yahweh, the splendor of our God. Lebanon was a mountain range that was emblematic in Scripture of majesty and glory, and spectacular wonder. Carmel represented beauty, and Sharon represented fertility and plush vegetation. So you see what it does say? What he's saying is the leech of death is going to be done away with. There will be no second law of thermodynamics anymore, physically or spiritually. And instead of the colossus goodness of life drying up, instead the desert wasteland of life will turn into a colossus paradise. That's the promise of chapter 35. So how does that sound? Sound good? I mean, relationships will just be like a plant in a garden that just gets greener and healthier and bears more fruit than you can harvest. Things will flourish. Your prayer life will just naturally grow and flourish, and the dried up weeds and thorns that are creating pain in your soul will turn to plush green pastures that comfort and nourish. That's the promise. And that's why this chapter 35 is directed at people who are weak and suffering and faltering. If you look at verse 3, let's keep reading. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. And say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come and save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Now throughout Isaiah, the promise that the blind will see and the deaf will hear apply both physically and spiritually. And we'll get to that in the weeks to come. but God is going to heal blind and deaf people physically as an illustration that he's going to do that spiritually when this promise comes to fruition. So the day is coming when God's people will no longer trust in the nations, but trust in God, and then all this will happen. Verse 6, then the lame will leap like a deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. Isn't that beautiful imagery? If you understand what that's saying about life, isn't that beautiful? So many of you right now are in the midst of walking across the hot, burning, fiery sand in the harsh trials of your life. And you're not even sure if you can take the pain one more day. Verse 7 is a precious promise, isn't it? That hot, burning sand is going to turn to cold, refreshing spring water bubbling up around you. And if all that isn't enough, verse 8, everything gets better. In verse 8, we see this. We see an on-ramp. Look at verse 8. And a highway will be there. Now, this is not the normal word for a road or a path. This is not direct. It's just like our word highway. It means to be elevated, an elevated road. It's lifted up. And it refers to a main road between cities that's wide and smooth and doesn't have any obstacles. And so the imagery, Isaiah uses this term to symbolize quick, easy access to something, to a place. I'll just give you one example. Isaiah 19:23. In that day there will be a highway, same word, from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will go to Egypt. The Egyptians will go to Assyria. And Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together. The idea is easy, quick access. So anyway, we're on this highway in verse 8. And the highway will be there, and it will be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean will not journey on it. It will be for those who walk in that way. Wicked fools will not go about it. No more evil. Right now, the broad, easy road is the road to destruction, right? And we have to struggle and fight to stay on that difficult, narrow road. But it's not always going to be that way. When this day comes, the day is coming when the way of holiness will be broad and smooth. It'll be a highway. Verse 9, no lion will be there, nor will be any ferocious beast get up on it. The idea is it's too high, they can't get up there. There's no dangers that can get up there. They will not be found there, but only the redeemed will walk there. No pitfalls, no dangers, no snares, no temptations, no distractions, no obstacles. And then verse 10, and the ransomed of Yahweh will return. Will return home. And of course, the idea is return home from Babylon, from exile, but the imagery of this chapter goes way beyond just that. This is talking about finally coming home, the righteous. We will return home. We were sold to sin and bought back by the Lord, and we are going to be on the interstate back home. But on our journey, believe it or not, something is going to catch us. Something is going to overtake us. We're going to be zooming along without any trouble on this highway, and there's no wild animals are going to be able to catch up and overtake us. No thieves or anything like that is going to be able to overtake us. But in verse 10, something actually does catch up to us and overtake us. Take a look. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads, and gladness and joy will overtake them. And sorrow and sighing will flee away. Everlasting joy and gladness will come speeding up from behind and overwhelm you on your journey back home. No wonder Psalm 84:5 says, blessed are those whose strength is in you and who have set their hearts on the highway. So that's the promise. Someday Messiah will come and put his kingdom in place, and life itself is going to flourish like the cedars of Lebanon. And best of all, better than all that, we're going to be on the fast track, bullet train, nonstop to Zion, the dwelling place of God. And we're going to be on the highway to God, flying along so fast that the only thing that will be able to catch up to us is everlasting joy and gladness. Now, that's just a little bit of background from Isaiah 35. With that in mind, let's turn over to Matthew 15. We're studying the works of Jesus and the miracles of Jesus, and we've been doing that all summer, but I just wanted to show you a little background so you can appreciate what takes place in this particular event. Just to get you up to speed, Jesus has performed his mightiest, most spectacular miracle in Israel, the feeding of the 5,000, and they rejected him. And that's a peak of his popularity, and from there he kind of turns away from the crowds, turns away from Israel, and just focuses on the disciples. And the rejection of Christ builds from here on out. He's got 1 year left in his life. He tested their faith, the faith of the crowds in Israel, and found it to be non-existent. So he takes the 12 and leaves Israel and goes up into pagan land in an area of the vile, wicked Tyre and Sidon. And in that evil place, he finds what appears to be a worthless, unclean, Gentile, Canaanite woman. And he tests her faith and exposes the fact that she actually has great faith. She's one of the great heroes of the faith. Then, verse 29 of Matthew 15. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Now, you might not think anything of that until you check over at Mark. And Mark, in the parallel account, tells you the route that he took to the Sea of Galilee. And I keep forgetting to put up my map. But you got where Jesus was here. And then he goes up north to Tyre, basically. And then Galilee, the Sea of Galilee is over here. But he travels. Mark 7:31 says Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee into the region of Decapolis, which is east of Israel. So it's a really very circuitous route. He's going up 20-some miles north and then all the way around. It'd be kind of like if you're going to walk from here to DIA by way of Fort Collins, is the idea. So obviously, Jesus is going out of his way to be alone with his disciples. He goes to a foreign country and wanders all over, staying on the move, remaining obscure as he can. Finally comes all the way back down and gets to the Decapolis area, the 10-city area that's on the other, just east side of Israel there. And that's where Matthew picks up the story. Now, I'm gonna go through this, and we're going to do two things this morning. I'm going to show you, first of all, three things that we can learn from Jesus' example of ministry, things we can learn about how to do ministry from Jesus' example. And then I want to show you the theological purpose of this passage, and that's where this really gets fascinating. So let's see if we can get all this in. Verse 29 of Matthew 15. Then he went on a mountainside and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. So he mentions those four categories plus many others, and laid them, literally cast them at his feet, and he healed them. Now that's it. That's the whole account. Frankly, I got to admit, when I saw that, I thought, okay, I guess I'm going to be preaching on the feeding of the 4,000, which is the next event. Because what are you going to say about this? You know, the crowd, it's another one of those things. It keeps on happening. Crowd comes, a bunch of sick people, and Jesus healed them all. What's there to say? And we haven't spent much time with that, because how does he do that? I mean, have you ever wondered how Jesus healed the whole crowd? Every time we see this, I've mentioned it, but we haven't spent a lot of detail on it, because there's no detail in the text. Have you ever wondered how he did it? Did he just sort of wave his hand over the whole crowd and heal them all in one shot? Or did he take each individual one and do a whole ordeal with each one individually? Well, this is a perfect place to ask that question, because the parallel account in Mark gives us an idea. So, flip over to Mark 7. Mark tells us the same account, except he gives us one example. Look at verse 32 of Mark 7. It says, there some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged him to place his hand on the man. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven with a deep sigh and said, Ephphatha, which means be opened. At this, the man's ears were opened and his tongue was loosed, and he began to speak plainly. So that's wonderful. He heals this guy. And we're going to talk about the healing and the spitting and all that stuff in a minute. But first, I just want to point out the fact that this, when you see this little offhanded remark in the Gospels, like you saw in Matthew, that he just healed a crowd, don't think that that's just one sweeping thing. It's made up of hundreds of individual events like this. And Mark just pulls out one of those examples to show us. The Gospel writers, when they gave us the stories that they gave us, they didn't just pick out the most exciting ones, the most thrilling, the most spectacular. They picked out the ones that fit their theological purpose, but they left the vast majority out just because of space concerns. They just didn't have enough room. When you hear about Jesus healing an entire crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people bringing their sick. You might wonder, how did Jesus heal so many people efficiently? And the answer is, he didn't heal them efficiently. He did it inefficiently. He just did one at a time. Dr. Paul Brand, who works with lepers, wrote the book Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. In that book, he has an interesting quote. He says, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the eyes of the blind. He touched the skin of the person with leprosy and the legs of the cripple. I have sometimes wondered why Jesus so frequently touched the people he healed, many of whom have been unattractive, obviously diseased, unsanitary, and smelly. With his power, he easily could have waved a magic wand. In fact, a wand would have reached more people than a touch. He could have divided the crowd into affinity groups and organized his miracles. Paralyzed people over here, feverish people here, people with leprosy over there, raising his hands to heal each group efficiently in mass. But he chose not to. Jesus' mission was not chiefly a mission against disease, but rather a ministry to individual people. He wanted those people, one by one, to feel his love and warmth and his full identification of them with them. Jesus knew he could not readily demonstrate love to a crowd, for love usually involves touching. I think that's an insightful thought about why Jesus did this. He healed the people one at a time in a personal way. And we're just looking at one this morning, but I want to show you this because there's so much we can learn about Jesus, especially his compassion, but three things that I'm going to point out. First, we'll look at his compassion. Let's look at it. Verse 32, they brought a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. It's really a tragic figure. In that day, you might think that deafness maybe isn't that bad. If you had a choice between being deaf and or blind, maybe you think, well, I'd rather be deaf. But deafness is no picnic, especially in the ancient world. Blind people don't suffer the social pain and stigma that deaf people do. People gawking and the stares of impatient people who don't know that you're deaf and are waiting for a response. On top of that, the humiliation of people always assuming that you're stupid because of the way that you talk, because that's the way that the way that deaf people often talk. People would assume that there's some mental problem. Deaf people aren't any less intelligent than anyone else, but their speech sometimes make it seem that way to people who don't know what's going on. And on top of all that is the fact that there would have been no way to learn in that day. They didn't have special ed. They didn't have schools for the deaf. This man couldn't ask questions. He couldn't hear any teaching. No doubt he was unable to read. And so the truth of the scriptures are totally cut off from him. His condition is terrible. And we see that in the concern of his friends who are begging Jesus for help. And it's the result seems to be this guy became somewhat timid and shy. He can walk just fine, and yet it says some people brought him to Jesus. He doesn't seem to be able to come on his own. They beg Jesus to touch him and heal him. He doesn't seem to have any initiative on his own. So they're begging him, verse 32, Jesus, to place his hand on the man, and after he took him aside from the crowd, Jesus, the crowd is there, they're all coming, they're casting people down at Jesus' feet, throwing them down there, sick people, and Jesus gets this one guy and focuses on him, and he said, you come here, and he brings him over, and he steps away from the whole crowd, and steps over all these people, and excuse me, we're over here, we're coming, and he gets them all the way over here, away from the crowd. So this is just the disciples are going to see this. And then he puts his fingers into the man's ears and spit and touch the man's tongue. Now what is that? Why does Jesus do that, and why does Mark record it? I think one clue comes from the fact, and this is an interesting thing to notice, that this is not, he did not touch the man's ears in order to heal them. We know that because after he touched them, he's still not healed. This is not a healing touch. Jesus often touched, healed with a touch, but not here. I think it's very simple. He's just communicating to the guy. He did it to communicate to the man. He can't say, okay, I'm going to heal your ears now. He can't do like he did with some people, say, what do you want? And the guy says, and he answers. He can't have a dialogue with the guy. And so he puts his fingers in it. That's sign language. That's all it is. It's just some sign language. Jesus was saying, this, what I'm about to do is resulting from my touch. I'm going to do something with your ears. So you say, well, what about the spitting? Now, that's really fun to read the commentaries on that. They go all over the place with the spitting. Some commentaries say that Jesus spit on the guy's tongue because saliva was thought by many to have some kind of a healing property. Others say, no, that's too gross, and so they say he spit on his fingers and then he touched the tongue. One commentary said that Jesus spit on the ground. Can I point something out to you from that the text does not say that Jesus spit on anything. I don't think we need to turn this into something profane or gross. You know, it's not like Jesus standing there hawking loogies on this guy. I mean, I think it's just more sign language. He does something with his mouth. Jesus does something with his mouth, and he touches the man's tongue to communicate, I'm about to do something to your mouth. Just, you know, and then he touches his tongue. He's just communicating through sign language, the way this guy can understand. He's saying, your ears are stopped, I'm going to unplug them. Your tongue is dried up, I'm going to make it so you can speak again. He just does it in a personal way. He's touching the man. It's a very personal miracle. No doubt they all were. So verse 34, look down at verse 34. With a deep sigh, Jesus looked to heaven with a deep sigh, and the man couldn't hear that, but he could see it. That's sign language for I care about you. I mean, this situation moves me. Jesus got this guy up close, and he could see the devastation of his life and the shyness and the crumpled spirit and the hurt upon hurt upon hurt, and it moved his great heart. That's one of the secrets to compassion. This is what we're learning from Jesus' example, is his compassion. And that's one of the secrets. You get the person in front of you, and you look at them. You pull aside one of the needy, tragic figures around you and look the person in the eye and give them your direct attention. And in many cases, we don't want to do that. We don't want to look a needy person in the eye because we're afraid of what it might end up costing us to show compassion to that person. But showing compassion was so important to God that he did that. In fact, this is a picture of the whole incarnation, if you think about it. God was not content to just sit up in heaven and feel sorry for us. He wasn't content to sit up in heaven and just feel compassion. He had to come to earth, set aside his glory, take on human weakness, suffer himself, so that he could identify with our suffering. No matter where you look in Jesus' ministry, you're going to see this. Matthew 8, after healing all the people, it says, this was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. He didn't just heal. He took the sorrow upon himself. And that's more than just the cross. That's his whole life. It was his approach to people. So many times when Jesus heals someone, the gospel writer says he had compassion and then he healed. They mention his compassion first. They could see it on his face. It was obvious that he was compassionate. It wasn't just healing, it was compassion and healing, and the compassion was visible. Hebrews 4:15, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. Puts it in the double negative there to make it emphatic. Someone once said, there is no place where earth's sorrows are felt more than in heaven. Great statement. You know, that's where the effort came in Jesus' ministry. It's an interesting thing to think about. The healing part is always effortless for Jesus. He just does that instantly with a thought or a touch or a word. The healing is never labor-intensive for Jesus, like it often was for Old Testament prophets. What was labor-intensive for Jesus was the time and energy and effort that went into showing genuine compassion. It's another area where Jesus is the opposite of modern faith healers. For them, for the modern guys on TV, it's a big effort to try and get the person actually healed, but the amount of energy put into relating to that person personally is very minimal. For Jesus, it was the opposite. The miracle is the easiest part. Much more humanly taxing was the work of caring and loving. It's always the part where you see tears flowing from Jesus or a great sigh or some other significant expression of effort. In the amazing, unfathomable paradox of Jesus, the union of Jesus' divine nature and his human nature, he could move heaven and earth effortlessly, but caring and loving for the lowly was as taxing and draining and arduous for him as it is for us. So that's our example. That's the hardest part of ministry. It really is. I mean, there are some aspects of ministry that are arduous and hard. Learning Greek or Hebrew, that's hard. Showing up at church early in the morning to rehearse worship, the worship team, that's hard. That's taxing. Being faithful week after week after week in a ministry where nobody acknowledges what you're doing, that's hard. Those things are hard, but nothing is as hard as caring. Really caring for people in pain. It's so easy to become like the emergency room doctor who becomes indifferent to suffering. He can do that. A doctor can administer medicine just as well, regardless of whether he feels for the person or not. But spiritual medicine isn't like that. We can't do that. Spiritual medicine that we have to offer has its most profound, potent effect if it's administered in love, right? That's part of the medicine. And I know most of you well enough to know that what you really long for is an effective ministry in the service of God. You want to hear God say, "Well done, my faithful servant." Well, you want to have a powerful ministry? Don't shut off the valve of compassion. Genuinely care about people's suffering, and they will flock to you. And then when they come, give them God's word, and you will have an eternally powerful ministry. None of us were meant to go through life with dry eyes. So from Jesus' example, we learn compassion. Second thing we learn from Jesus is his example, or his reliance on divine power rather than human methods. Look at what he does in verse 34. He looks up to heaven. I think that's more sign language for you're about to be healed not by magic or anything else, but by power from God. The God who made your ears is now going to repair them. Calls to mind Exodus 4:11 when God said to Moses, "Who gave man his mouth?" When Moses is trying to argue about whether he can speak. "Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, Yahweh?" There's so many applications to understanding that God is the creator, and one of them is this. If you have a problem, you look to the one who created you to solve it. Christian life is a sacred balance between effort and reliance on God, right? We've talked about this so many times. On the one hand, the let go and let God crowd, the quietists who don't want to put any effort into anything, they're on one extreme. They're all for relying on God to act, but they refuse to lift a finger to become obedient instruments that God uses to act. On the other hand, the other extreme is the man-centered human religion, which sees God sort of as a philosophy or an inspiration, but doesn't really think of him as actually having any power or any ability to do anything. And those people think that if a human being doesn't do something, it won't get done. And so everything relies completely on human beings. That's man-centered religion. And the true Christian life avoids both errors. We are God-centered in our trust, and yet at the same time we strive to be obedient tools in God's hand. If you ever wondered if you have fallen off the beam into the error of being man-centered, just look at your prayer life. That's the perfect test. Just look at your prayer life. You can tell how much you rely on God and how much ultimately you rely on yourself by the way that you pray. I know in my ministry, you know, if my ministry is struggling and I can tell that it's being fruitless or whatever, you can tell how much I look to God as the source of spiritual life by how much I'm going to resort to prayer in a time like that, as opposed to resorting to and reverting to my own ingenuity and creativity and problem-solving skills. If I see Him as the source of the flow of spiritual life, I'm going to be turning to Him when I need that. I mean, if Jesus had a need to look to heaven and to pray, how much more do we? So verse 34, we see the miracle. He said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." That's an Aramaic word. Mark is translating everything into Greek here, but he takes that one word that Jesus said and leaves it in Jesus' original language, Aramaic. Doesn't translate it. He wants us to hear the exact syllables that Jesus said. I don't know why. Maybe one possibility is Ephphatha would be an easy word to lip read, wouldn't it? Maybe that has something to do with it. But he does tell us what the word means. It's a command. Jesus is commanding this man's ears and mouth to be opened. When Jesus gives a command to a non-personal thing like a storm or ears, there's never any delay in that command being fulfilled. And I trust that's the same thing that happened here. That's what the indication of the text is. Which means that the very first sound that this man would have heard would be the Jesus' voice saying, Ephatha, right? Because it would take about, what I figured, about 1/500th of a second for that sound to get from Jesus' mouth to the guy's ears. By then, he's already fully healed. And so he heard this sound. First sound he heard was Jesus' voice. And verse 35, at this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. He didn't have to learn to talk. He didn't need speech therapy. In a split second, Jesus not only repaired physically what was wrong in his ears and reconnected what was wrong in his brain and whatever else, but he instantly trained the man's brain to be able to properly interpret the sounds that he's hearing and then to speak properly, a process that normally would take years. And so he just miraculously, wonderfully heals this guy. And then he moved on to the next guy in the crowd. And then the next guy, and each one, he does this. This is why these healing events take so long. Just imagine. All those categories, remember the four categories Matthew mentioned? Just think of one of them, the crippled. I mentioned that one because that's an interesting word. The word cripple, it literally means somebody who's missing limbs. Jesus was healing those people. I mean, somebody, they carry some guy up with one leg, and the guy walks away. He gets a new leg. Someone comes up with just one arm, and he walks away with two arms. Somebody with no eye, he has an eye. I mean, Jesus is replacing limbs on the spot. It's not one of these deals where, you know, Jesus healed me, and I've been feeling better ever since, you know, or whatever. Start progressively getting better. It's not that kind of thing. It's not just, you know, lower back pain, a little bit less severe. It wasn't somebody in a wheelchair who could stand up and balance for a second. It's somebody missing a limb, and suddenly he has one. So we learn from Jesus' example of compassion. We learn from his example of reliance on divine power instead of human methods, which is fascinating since he himself was God. But then the third one is a little bit more subtle. Look at verse 36. Jesus commanded them, talking about the friends who brought this man, not to tell anyone. Don't tell anyone. Now, that's a very common theme, especially in Mark. We see that again and again. It might seem a little odd to you, but it's heavily emphasized in the Bible. When Jesus healed the leper in chapter 1, verse 43, it says Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. And that's really strong wording in the Greek. Very strong warning. See to it that you do not tell anyone. Mark 3:10, it says he healed many, verse 12, but he gave them strict orders not to tell who he was. In chapter 5, Jesus raised a girl from the dead, and verse 43, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this. In chapter 8, we're going to see Jesus heal a blind man, and it says Jesus sent him home saying, don't go to the village. In Matthew, you see the same thing. Matthew 9, Jesus heals a whole group of blind men. Verse 30, Jesus warned them sternly, see that no one hears about this. Then in chapter 12, he heals a man with a withered hand. And verse 15, Jesus withdrew from that place. Many followed him, and he healed all their sick, and warning them not to tell who he was. Then Matthew goes on and gives an explanation. Verse 17, this was to fulfill what was spoken to the prophet Isaiah. Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him. He will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the street. The idea is the Messiah is going to come with a composed dignity. He's not going to be screaming and wrangling in the streets for attention. Those who study the life of Jesus refer to this as the messianic secret. And whenever you see that in a book, the messianic secret, the word secret is always in quotes, and I always kind of chuckle at that. They put it in quotes because it's more like a messianic secret attempt. It's never very successful. Jesus, whenever he commands them not to tell, they always immediately go and tell everyone that they can see. And that's exactly what happens here. Why did Jesus do this? What is it? What is this? People in our day have been very perplexed at this. If Jesus came here to reach the world, why is he forbidding people to proclaim who he is? He spends his life going around preaching, and then he commands his apostles to go around and spend their lives preaching, and he commissions his followers to go out and reach the whole world. How does that fit with him constantly telling people to keep it quiet? And I think the reason that's such a puzzle and a mystery to us today is because in our day we idolize publicity. We don't understand the difference between publicity and proclamation. The politicians and celebrity wannabes in our day clamor in the streets for attention, any attention that they can possibly get. No press is bad press for them. But Jesus was not interested in name recognition alone or gaining power through popularity or through human connections or any of that. He wasn't interested in getting the maximum number of people at a rally. He was only interested in seeking and saving the lost through preaching the gospel, the kingdom, to those the Father was drawing. Jesus never prohibited people from proclaiming the gospel. Think about what he's forbidding here. What he did forbid was the sheer just publicity over his miracles, because all that does is bring the thrill seekers. And the thrill seekers were the last group Jesus wanted, because they weren't interested in repentance. They weren't interested in finding forgiveness and submitting to his lordship or anything. They just wanted entertainment. They wanted amusement. They wanted to see the tricks. And all they did was hinder Jesus from his ministry of proclaiming the gospel to those who were interested, because they got in his way. It's why, for example, at Creekside, we don't do big concerts to draw in unbelievers who are seeking entertainment in order to try and reach them. Instead, we just advertise to the world that here we preach the gospel. And then when people come, that's all we give them is God's word. I think this is what we can learn from Jesus' approach. And it may shock some of you to realize this, but you know what Jesus is forbidding these people to do? Give their testimony. Don't give your testimony, is basically what he's telling them. If all your testimony is about physical healing. See, don't get me wrong. Testimonies are wonderful. Sharing your testimony. If your testimony is about how God transformed your heart and forgave your sins, then sharing your testimony is one of those powerful ways you can proclaim the gospel. But if your testimony is just a story about how God improved your external circumstances and that's it, sharing that is going to just do more harm than good. That's worthless. I've been to evangelistic meetings, so-called evangelistic meetings, where people got up and said, you know, I used to be on drugs, and then I had this problem, and I was poor, and everything else. And then I came to Jesus, and now all my circumstances are better, I don't have any of those problems. And the thrill seekers just come streaming up to the front at the invitation, because they want that. But those are the very people Jesus drove away. They don't care about Jesus, they don't care about what he teaches, they don't want to follow him, they just want to see his tricks. And they hinder his ministry. So the third thing we can learn from Jesus' example in the ministry is to focus on God's purposes, not popularity. So Jesus tells these people to be quiet, but then look what they do. Verse 36, the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. Not only did they disobey, but they disobeyed. He told them again, no, don't say it. And so then they said it more. And then he told them to stop more. And then they said it more. And the more he told them to stop, the more they said it. He kept cranking up the intensity of his command. They kept cranking up the intensity of their disobedience, and they kept on explaining it. And the reason is, in verse 37, the people were overwhelmed with amazement. They couldn't help it. And the point of this is Jesus' miracles were so absolutely astonishing and astounding and amazing that it was just impossible to keep it a secret. He has done everything well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. In Matthew's account in verse 31 of Matthew 15, it says the people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking and the crippled made well and the lame walking and the blind seeing, and they praised God of Israel. They praised the God of Israel. Remember, this is Gentile territory, praising the God of Israel. And I point that out because I want to show you, we're going to wrap up here by showing you the theological meaning of this. Let me show you what Mark is doing in the way that he reports this. Israel has been waiting now for hundreds of years in anticipation of the restoration promises of the prophets. Chapters like Isaiah 35, they've been waiting for hundreds of years for that to be fulfilled. They longed and prayed for God to come and turn the desert waste into paradise and the glory of ancient Lebanon. They longed for the day when the Messiah would come and set up his kingdom. They longed for the day when the eyes of the blind would be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped and the lame would leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. Now, Mark is very deliberate in the wording that he uses, in the way that he describes this. This is not just a random miraculous healing that's not connected to anything. Look at the word he uses for mute. When he first introduces this guy and he says he could hardly speak, the normal word for mute is kophos, the Greek word kophos, very common word, but Mark does not use that here. He uses a completely different word, which is a very, very rare word. And in the Bible, it's only used here, and then one place in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Guess where? Isaiah 35. That's the only place it's used in the whole Bible. Mark is alluding to Isaiah 35 in the way that he describes this. And it's not just that word, it's the whole scene. Jesus goes up to the area of Lebanon. That's where Tyre and Sidon is. Is that ancient Lebanon area. He goes up into Lebanon, finds a deaf mute, and makes him hear and speak, and Mark describes it in the language of Isaiah 35. And then the result is even the Gentiles, the nations, being so amazed that they're overcome with rejoicing, and they're praising the God of Israel, praising Jesus, saying, He has done all things. And then guess what that word is? Kalas. Well, beautiful, good. He's restoring things to goodness. This is it. This is the inauguration of the kingdom that's going to turn the desert into a paradise. The arrival of Jesus Christ. That's the underlying point here. And you might see that and say, well, that's fine, but honestly, I still feel very much like I'm in the desert, frankly. Life is still very desert-like. And the reason for that is the present age that we're in now is the desert, and the age to come is the paradise. But at Jesus' first coming, he inaugurated the age to come and introduced it, and from that point until Jesus' second coming, in this period in between, we're living in this overlap where the age to come is breaking into this present age. That's our day. That's what's happening from Jesus' first coming on. It's not, the age comes not fully in place, but it is inaugurated. Turn to 2 Timothy 4. We've been reading, if you don't know this, our church, we as a church, are reading through the New Testament repetitively, so we take a section, two chapters or so, and we read that every day of the week for 2 weeks, and then we move on to the next section. We're just moving our way through the New Testament. If you haven't been doing that with us, now is the perfect time to start, because we just finished yesterday 2 Timothy, and we're going to start today with the Gospel of John. Anyway, so we've been reading the last 2 weeks, 2 Timothy 4. And there's a fascinating thing in verses 8 through 10. Fascinating contrast that you can't really see in the NIV, but it's great. Let me just show you. Verse 7, Paul is at the end of his life. He knows he's about to die. He's looking back over his whole life, and he says, I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. Now there is in store for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day, and not only to me, but also to who? To those all who have longed, literally loved, his appearing. Now the word loved there is a perfect participle, and the perfect tense refers to some completed action in the past with continuing results. Once a Christian perseveres all the way to the end like Paul did, he can look back over his whole Christian life, gather it all up into one big event, and say, I loved his appearing. That's the Christian life, summarized, from beginning to end. It's Paul just looks back and he says, I loved his appearing. A Christian who perseveres all the way in is someone who loved Christ's appearing. You be in eternity in heaven for a billion years, and you look back a billion years ago, back when you lived on earth, and they'll say, what was that like? That was a time when I loved his appearing. That's the Christian. Now, look at verse 9. Do your best to come to me quickly, for Demas, because he loved, same word, the world, and the word world there is literally this present age in the Greek. It's not cosmos, it's ion, it's this present age. He deserted me and went to Thessalonica. So it's very parallel in the Greek. The Christian is someone who loves Jesus coming, and here Demas loved the world, and this is an aorist. It's not a perfect. It's not referring to his whole life. It's just referring to the event where Demas apostatized, he decided to love the world. So the summary of that is there's two kinds of people. Just two. Those who love Jesus coming and those who love this present age. Either you live your life with all your hopes and motivations set on the promises of Isaiah 35, or you live your life just trying to make this desert as comfortable as you can, and you love this present age. Christians are strangers here, and we're so odd in this world because a Christian is someone whose life doesn't appear to make any logical sense to someone in the world because we are not living for this present age. They can't understand the way we live because living for the age to come is going to cause you to make completely different decisions than living for this present age. And that's the Christian life. To love his coming, not this present age. And the glory of this event in Mark 7 is that age to come has been inaugurated already. Already in place. Which is guarantees that all the promises in their fullest sense are going to come. I really hope this picture that Mark ends with and Matthew ends with the Gentiles rejoicing because the arrival of the one who's going to inaugurate the age to come, I hope that picture is a picture of us. Right? I hope that's us. Exuberant rejoicing. Just because of one tiny little foretaste of the inauguration of the age to come. And if they have that kind of enthusiastic rejoicing over superficial things like physical healing, what kind of rejoicing should we be engaged in who have been exposed to the glories of the gospel and the spiritual wonders of the age to come that are present already in our hearts? What kind of rejoicing should we respond with? I'll let you answer that with this last hymn. As the worshiper, as Terry or whoever comes back up, we're going to sing Joy to the World. And stop thinking about Christmas. This isn't a Christmas thing. This is a song about, you know, that this is a perfect song for this account because when you sing Joy to the World, you're not sure if this is talking about Jesus' first coming or his second coming, right? You know, at first, it's Joy to the World. Obviously, we've gotten the impression that it's his first coming. We sing this at Christmas time to celebrate his birth. But then you look at verse 3 there in your bulletin. No more let sins and sorrows grow. See, this is the fullness of Isaiah 35, the full-blown promise of the age to come, the colossal goodness and paradise. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. Curse is done. He comes to make his blessings flow. As how far? As far as the curse is found. Everything that's cursed, that's how far the reversal of the curse is going to go. What, I love that verse. Far as the curse is found. Let's stand and sing this in an appropriate way, given what we just saw.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him room. And heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing. Joy to the earth, the Savior reigns. Let men their songs employ, while fields and floods rise.